This is the Thirsty Developer, episode number 18 for April 8th, 2008, a conversation with Jeff Atwood. So Larry, every year, Microsoft has this technology summit out in Redmond. It's actually affectionately called the Microsoft Technology Summit. It's actually
creativity was in an all time low when they named that, didn't they?
Maybe so, but it's an invite only event that we have where we kind of invite people who aren't necessarily, I would say, Microsoft haters per se, but they don't necessarily agree with Microsoft. You know, kind of in, you know, maybe in their daily business or their daily interactions with Microsoft and its technologies, they don't necessarily agree with everything that Microsoft does, which is okay. It's fine. So what we do is we actually kind of invite these people to kind of have them come out to Redmond and essentially have a conversation. You know, we set it up as a two-way conversation, and we bring in people from the product teams to kind of show, you know, what kind of technologies we're working on, what kind of new tools we're coming out with, and kind of get feedback, and also just to kind of bounce ideas off them, say, are we heading the right direction? And one of the people that actually attended last week was Jeff Atwood of Coding Horror Fame.
Yeah, Jeff's a really cool guy. I've been following his blog for years, and it's funny, even before I started following blogs regularly, when I would search for something on the internet, you know, invariably, you know, once a week, twice a week or whatever, I would land on his blog because there's a lot of people that point to him because he's, you know, really, you know, popular, well-known blogger. But he has a lot of interesting things to say about things that, you know, developers and architects care about.
Right. So Jeff actually, he used to work for Vertigo Software. He no longer works there. He's actually doing his own thing now. But, I mean, he's one of these guys who was a developer, you know, total geek at heart. And he just started blogging one day because it's something that he wanted to do, you know, kind of as an outlet to kind of get some of his thoughts out there.
As I recall, it was a New Year's resolution that he said he wanted to create a list of books that programmers would get a lot out of.
Right.
And it just turned into, you know, a blog that he updates almost on a daily basis.
I don't know
right?
how he does it. But yeah. The things that he blogs about, it's not necessarily about, you know, how to in development, but it's kind of just more of general. His thoughts around kind of things in the industry, things in the blogosphere, things that are going around technology-wise. But, you know, very insightful stuff. And like I said, I don't know how he does it. But I had a chance to sit down with Jeff, and we had a nice little conversation. And so let's why don't we take a listen on that?
Let's roll the tape.
So Jeff Atwood of Coding Horror Fame, how are you?
I'm good.
Good. So, you know, you have a very popular blog, codinghorror.com. So, you know, there's a lot of people out there I know that read your blog. And I've never known Jeff Atwood, kind of like what you did before Coding Horror. What's your background? What have you done and where are you going?
Well, I'm sort of a longtime Windows ecosystem developer. Started with a lot of the early Microsoft basics on early platforms like the Amiga and Apple and the TI-99/4A. Those all run variants of Microsoft Basic. So I'm sort of a basic developer at heart, but I'm not opposed to other languages and, you know, other futures, obviously. So coming from the Microsoft background and just graduating from college and getting my first job writing essentially Visual Basic code for money, and I started actually with Fox Pro for DOS as well, so going back to the DOS days. So I think a lot of that's in my background. So I've just always considered Microsoft sort of a friend of developers, you know.
Right.
But I'm somewhat agnostic about it, but I enjoy working in the Microsoft stack.
So the past however many years you worked actually for Vertigo, and I'm sure you worked on some pretty interesting projects there, utilizing some of the latest technology. But Vertigo is one of these companies known for, you know, creating these amazing demos utilizing the latest technologies from Microsoft. Were you part of any of that?
I was for some of them indirectly, but that's also how I learned about Vertigo, was through .NET Pet Shop. And they also participated in that famous .NET versus Java study that was very controversial. You remember that?
Yes,
that was big.
Why don't you like kind of bring us up to speed on that for people who aren't aware of that?
Right. So when C# and the whole .NET stack really was being introduced, Microsoft funded a study to see, you know, what are the productivity differences of using, say, Visual Studio versus what Java developers had at the time.
Right.
And granted, the landscape has changed since then. This is a point in history. So that was around, I would say, 2003. I want to say 2003, maybe 2004.
Mm-hmm.
So it was early in the life cycle. And it was very controversial because the study actually found that using Visual Studio was much more productive because the Java developers spend a lot of time messing around with their stack. Whereas from Microsoft, you sort of get a pre-built solution that you can install sort of out of the box and kind of be productive with. And that was sort of a big win for the teams.
Wasn't there also like a lot of questions on the differing architectures of the both applications? On
well, sure. I think it's a difficult study to do apples to apples on.
Right.
I still think the conclusions are largely true, but I think Eclipse has become a lot better since then.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really, the mitigating factor.
Right.
So that was one of the things Vertigo did. And then recently, Vertigo's been doing a lot of stuff with Silverlight and WPF, the .show family of applications.
Like video.show.
Yeah, video.show, show, slide.show, all that stuff. So certainly Vertigo tries to be on the cutting edge of what we perceive to be the next big Microsoft technologies that we think are going to be, well, I shouldn't say we because I don't actually work for Vertigo
anymore.
Right,
I was going to say, it's no longer we, it's them.
But I still, they're very, very close friends.
Right.
It's a very amicable parting, so I do consider them kind of family almost literally. So I'm very comfortable talking about it, and I think they would be comfortable hearing it too. So, I mean, Vertigo is a great place to work. I encourage everybody to check out the Vertigo website and see the demos that we've built.
Yep. So they're actually built one of the probably most talked about demos for Mix, which was the Hard Rock.
Oh yeah, that's
Deep
right.
Zoom demo.
That's right. So that was a new Silverlight 2 feature, the Deep Zoom feature, and I'm a big, as I call it, a fake plastic rock fan, in that I play. I love music. First of all, I just love music, like all kinds of music. I'm a big music fan, always have been. No musical ability whatsoever. So for me, the fake plastic musical instruments are great because I get to experience my music and play along. But the Hard Rock thing, those are real musicians,
right?
Like they have Bo Diddley's guitar and
right.
Like Eddie Van Halen's guitar. And like I think they have the most expensive Les Paul guitar in the catalog. It's some really famous, famous model of Les Paul. And they said like in the memorabilia site when they find it, it's like, this is the most valuable piece in our collection. That's saying a lot.
Right, yeah, exactly.
So it's cool. It's fun to browse, and, you get that experience of, like, the 10-mile view of seeing all this really cool collectible stuff, and you can just zoom in. You can group by collection. You have to see it to really understand
right.
it, and I encourage people to go. It's memorabilia.hardrock.com.
Yeah.
And it's really fun to play with, and, of course, it's Silverlight, so it works on the Mac. It works on Firefox, all that good stuff.
Yeah, great. So since then, you've left Vertigo. And so now what is Jeff Atwood doing?
So what happened to me at Vertigo was that my blog, which is something I had done before Vertigo, and I had been using it sort of at the time as a way to show people, like, this is what I'm about. This is what I do, right?
We were actually talking yesterday where you said, I kind of asked you, how did you get started with your blog? And you said it was more kind of, you needed an outlet for yourself.
Well, it was that too, but it's really both of those things. So it was also an outlet professionally for me where I was at a job at the time where I really didn't have a lot of other software developers that enjoyed really digging into software development stuff as much as I did. Not to fault any of them, it's just that I was kind of like obsessed with it, and they were like, well, it's interesting. But
into what aspects? The technology or just...
Well, I think the whole stack. Like, computers to me have been a part of my life from like the earliest days when
right.
I was a kid. Like, I've just always been fascinated with it, and, I wanted to find someone that... people that really shared my fascination, and you don't always get that out of necessarily the person you're married to, obviously, or even necessarily your closest friends. So it's like, who do you turn to?
Mm-hmm.
Usually it's the people you work with because
yep.
you're working in the stuff that you love, hopefully, in a perfect world.
They understand your language.
Yeah, they understand your language. That's all good. But it wasn't – I was just way more into it than they were. So there's a disconnect there. So that was one of the reasons I started the blog. And then the other reason I started was just – and really kind of a side effect, frankly, is like, look, this is what I do. This is what I'm about. You can just go here and see, and there's not a big disconnect. Like, what I do for fun is pretty much what I do for work.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's what the blog is. I was doing it because I enjoyed it. It's the same reason that, I was doing the work stuff. So when I interviewed at Vertigo, Scott actually read my blog. And over time, the blog just ballooned and became this really big phenomenon. I'm still not entirely sure why. I'm very appreciative, and I'm very humbled by its success, but I still can't really explain what happened there. Over time, I wanted to pursue that and just make that my main focus. Like, that became more significant than me working on anything at Vertigo, which sounds odd, but...
Right. So I have actually, so I have a blog, and we kind of talked about this once again, about, since I joined Microsoft, I find it harder to find things to blog about that's unique, that's, that I'm not just repeating what somebody's already said, or, somebody can say it more eloquently than I can. But so how do you keep up on what you blog about? Is it just what's on your mind that day? I mean, do you keep like a rolling list of things you want to post about or talk about, have a discussion around? Like, what are the things that you look to blog about, I guess?
Well, I think part of it's a personality thing where I really just enjoy like the minutiae of stuff. like, and I just, and people at work have said, well, again, my previous place of work have said to me, it's like, Jeff, the thing with you is like, you're obsessed with very small things. Like you have a lot of passion about small things, and you sort of go from one thing to another. And that is kind of what it's like. I have very broad interests. And then I just love digging into a particular topic at a particular time. And that's just, I think, a part of my personality. So I think that makes me somewhat predisposed to be somewhat good at it.
Right.
And then I have a sort of background as I was always sort of an English guy. I was a pretty good writer. So I have to be careful when I give advice to people. It's kind of like Jared the Subway guy giving people advice about losing weight. It's like, wow, I lost 200 pounds. You know, eating Subway, you should too.
Right.
And I think there's an aspect of work to it. Like, if you set a schedule, this is the same thing I tell everybody. If you want to blog, just set a schedule and just really stick to it, right? Nothing else matters, like topic, content. Just do it. Get out there and do it and be consistent, and you will get better.
Mm-hmm.
I can't guarantee the whole Jared result set from that, right? But just doing it, I think.
Are you saying we should call
you
the Jared of blogging? Is that what you're saying?
I think there's some analogies there. I think it's unfair on some level for me to give advice. You know, it's like taking golfing advice from, you know, a professional golfer or whatever.
Right.
I mean, not that makes me any better than anybody else, but it's just something about it really clicked for me.
Yeah. So what are the things that you typically find bloggable, I guess? I mean, is it just, you know, something you see somebody say and you got to respond to it? Is it something that you're pointing out of, you know, you had a post the other day of kind of like the discussion of I think it was Eric Lippert's blog entry about talking about open, you know, what is it, how many Microsoft people need to touch an API, essentially, you know, the change a light bulb, you know, API call, and how many steps through that process. And you kind of, you know, somebody responded to, why don't you use open source? And, you know, it's like, if you're going to do it open source, then who's going to take care of all the localization, you know, who's going to take care of the documentation, who's going to do this, who's going to do that?
Well, one thing that came out of that, let me just point out that, so where a lot of these topics come from, and I think part of it's a personality thing, is I really become fascinated with these little details of computing, like the little facets of it become very interesting to me. And one of those facets was, well, why is it so difficult to ship a small change at Microsoft? And it's really, you know, because a lot of people will look at it from the outside and say, oh, you could just change this, and it'll be, you know, I could do it in 10 minutes.
Right.
But they don't work at large software companies, so they lack the perspective of what it really takes to ship something to that wide of an audience versus just, you know, upload it to your website as a zip file and have at it.
Right.
It's a totally different release process. And one thing that came out of that was very fascinating, and this is where I get that feedback going, is I had put a quote in there. It was actually from Raymond Chen, who's another very famous Microsoft blogger. And he had actually replied saying, well, in open source, they don't pay that tax. And who does that stuff? And the answer is pretty much nobody. Like, who localizes, who writes the documentation, who does the unsexy stuff?
The screenshots, all that.
Yeah, all the stuff that's necessary to really ship a commercial product. But in the open source world, somebody does it, but it's sort of vague how it happens. And what came out of that is Raymond Chen actually worked on the Linux kernel, from what I'm hearing, because it was vague in his quote. Like, he referenced stuff like he had done it.
Oh, right, yeah.
But yeah, I didn't know.
He was part of the process. And
yeah, evidently he was fairly intimately involved in the Linux kernel, like in the early, early days, like 2000 era.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned something from that. And, you know, that's the reason I post stuff like that.
Right.
Like, figuring out these little details, I think, are very interesting. And so Raymond was uniquely positioned to comment on that because he had done it. Right. It wasn't like him just conjecturing about the way things work in open source. He had actually participated, which for a guy like Raymond, I just assumed he was a hardcore Windows guy from the earliest days. So it was a neat piece of history, and I find that stuff really fascinating. I think the people aspect of it is probably the thing that I come back to more and more over time.
Right. So like there, you know, essentially you probably read that blog entry and you kind of ran across it. There's so many people blogging out there. It's just hard to keep up with everybody. I mean, I assume you kind of keep tabs on certain levels of people and just kind of hear what the discussion is going on elsewhere and kind of gathering that information and responding to a blog, you know, have a blog response to it, you know, what have you.
Certainly there's an aspect of meta-filtering to it, right? Like where I consume a lot.
That has to be a talent on how you filter essentially the noise out.
I think there's something to be
said
for that.
Somebody like Scoble, right, who has thousands of feeds that he processes.
That's right. And you're looking through it and going, okay, I think these five things are what everybody should be looking at or what are going to be important in the future. So certainly there's an aspect of filtering to it where I do take in a lot of input because people have remarked about that. It's like, well, how do you know all this stuff. It's like, well, first I read a lot. Like, I'm just reading nonstop. Like, I've been a long-term reader since I was a kid, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, how you become a good writer is you read all the time. So I'm like, yeah, I read and consume tons and tons of stuff. I'm a very, very fast reader. And part of what I do, and I know Scott Hanselman always criticizes me for this, and maybe rightfully so, is that I'm not necessarily writing new content all the time. I'm actually pointing out, oh, look at this.
Right.
And look how it relates to this and this and this. And then I'll add some commentary, but it's not like I'm writing a huge essay.
Right.
I think that's an okay model, because I think really my site is about variety.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like sometimes I do write long pieces. I have done that in the past, but it's a mixture. Sometimes I'll just point to stuff, say, look at this, or I'll say this is wrong. You know, I'll come up with a position on something.
Yeah.
Or it'll be about hardware. It'll be about software. It'll be about, to me, the whole ecosystem is so fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Like all the facets of it and how they relate is really the fun thing for me.
Right.
Versus like, I don't get deep. I'm more of a generalist than a specialist, for sure. And I think people kind of respond to that. And, you know, if you don't like what's on today, then look tomorrow. It might be something totally different.
Right.
Whereas with, like, Raymond Chen, you know you're going to get some Windows minutiae.
Right.
Which is fine, but that's
deep,
that's
deep
his thing.
Stuff,
yeah, that's his thing. But my thing is, like, all over the map. And I think that tends to appeal to a pretty broad audience over time.
So that's actually a good segue. So, so looking at today, right, we're in 2008, right? So what excites you today about technology or computing or even programming from that standpoint?
Well, I think... And we covered this earlier offline, but I think the idea that the first web bubble was too early in that not enough people had broadband to really get the internet out to sort of your parents, and also the idea that people accept the internet as like a part of daily life now.
Right.
Like in a way that's like woven into the fabric, like it's just understood. Oh, you're going to go onto MySpace or Facebook. These aren't weird words, or like the word blog is actually an accepted word, which I still find unbelievable. But it's become sort of a core part of at least American culture. I can't speak to the world, but I would assume many places in the world as well, largely due to just broadband and time. So a lot of these ideas they had in 1999 that were like, you know, that's insane, that'll never work, could actually work now. There's so many people actually online with fast connections to the internet. So I think that, to me, is the exciting thing. It's just the pervasiveness of the web and, Wikipedia. Look at Wikipedia. That's not that old.
Right.
And now it's like
it's huge.
The answer to pretty much any question you have.
Whether that's the right answer or not is another
Of course. That's
question.
A totally different discussion. But as a resource, it's amazing. And it's not advertising subsidized, which is really bucking the trend, right? It's actually a nonprofit.
Right.
Which that's a lot of pressure on those guys. I don't know if that'll last. But and YouTube, that's another thing. YouTube is how old? 2005?
Right.
I remember reading blog entries going back and going to 2004 and saying, wow, why didn't they just put a video up here?
Right.
They couldn't because YouTube didn't exist then. And
right.
Now it's like understood that if you talk about video, oh, here's this funny or amusing thing, or here's this interesting thing I want you to look at. There's YouTube, some kind of shared video
right.
there.
Now that broadband proliferation is out there, that people, when they click
sure.
on something, they don't necessarily have to wait because people are impatient. You know, if they click on something on the web and they have to wait, they just turn the damn thing off.
And right. And the
they
way
don't
YouTube.
Sit there.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. And also the way YouTube sort of cut the Gordian knot of like video codecs. Oh, is it QuickTime? Is it Windows Media? It's like just too much thinking. Right.
I
mean, forget the platform issues. It's just, I don't want to think about that. I just want it to work.
Right.
And I got to say Flash and Silverlight to some extent, win that battle because they say, look, we're just going to be in the browser and we're going to be ubiquitous and it's going to be trivial.
Right.
And these are all new things, right? I mean, things are changing very, very rapidly. Is my point. So it's just exciting that all that stuff is being realized now.
So are you excited as kind of a user or are you excited as a producer?
I think on both ends. The idea that whatever I want, I can kind of find. Like, it's just amusing to me that any amusing Saturday Night Live skit I can think of, I can pretty much find on YouTube and
right.
say, oh, I remember this. It's like, that's
great.
Well,
that's why I'm waiting for them to, you know, you go to places like Hulu.com, right, and they have, you know, the old Doogie Howser episodes, the old A-Team and stuff like that,
yeah.
right? It's like, that's what I want. I want the content from the old days because, to me,
yeah.
that's the TV that I remember. I think it was so much, even though it was so much cheesier, to me it was so much better because that was from my childhood.
Right.
You know, but I'm still waiting. And, you know, if anybody listens to this, I want them to do this. I'm still waiting for somebody to post all of the WizKids episodes. I don't know if you remember the show, the WizKids.
I totally remember WizKids. In fact,
WizKids was my favorite show.
This is an embarrassing anecdote. And actually, it's funny that you bring this up. But I actually wrote a program that emulated the WizKids, like, hacking session on my, Coleco Adam.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. And
so
I used the same password and everything. I think it was like Miles and I can't remember what it was. But
right.
yeah, it was based on the show. I wrote a program based on the show to pretend that I was in the show.
That's funny. So,
yeah.
Okay, so here's some WizKids trivia for you then. So what was the name of the computer in the...
Oh, I'm not
in his bedroom.
I'm not going to get it.
And then who was who was the reporter. You know, they always the kids, they always kind of team up with this newspaper reporter. What was his name?
I don't remember. But you know what I love about this, though, is I know there's a Wikipedia entry for it, right?
That's
I guarantee
right.
you. And that's what I'm talking about. That's what's so exciting.
I wonder if I should use this as kind of a contest. You know, somebody can win a Zune if they answer these questions.
But that's what's exciting about this, is all this shared stuff. Like, is going somewhere that's you know, can be found now.
Right.
Right? In some meaningful way for anybody on the planet who's like, oh, I remember WizKid. It's like, it could be in the, not even in the U.S. They could find it.
Right.
That's incredible. I mean, to me, that's amazing.
Right.
And that's, you know, the power of just pervasive broadband and the internet is really, we're seeing the vision get realized. And I think it's very exciting.
Right. Well, not to leave everybody hanging, but just to answer that question. So the name of the computer, I believe, was Ralph. If I'm not mistaken. And then the newspaper reporting was Farley.
Yeah, for the five.
For
no,
the five
I'm
people
sorry, that's
know.
Optimistic. For the one person listening. Who, but no, seriously.
I just want to show you my geek cred. That's all.
I totally remember that show. And I totally was obsessed.
I think it was only on for one season, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure it was canceled.
But it's you know, it came out during a time when... you know, when I was really getting into computers. I think I was in seventh grade or something like that, and that show came out. And I think that's what really hooked me. It was that.
Oh, yeah.
It was that.
No,
it was
I'm
that and
you.
War Games with
I'm
Matthew
with
Broderick.
Totally. I mean, that's all part of our shared history, right? I mean, being of a certain age. Totally agree.
All these young kids, they don't know how good they got. Just, you know, they're just spoiled.
All they have is that crappy movie Hackers with Angelina Jolie, and that sucked.
Actually, last night. So yeah, we're actually in, you know, Redmond, but we're staying in Bellevue, so we're kind of, you know, the home of Microsoft. And last night I was, you know, in the hotel room, and the movie Antitrust came on, and I just thought that was very ironic that, you know, here
isn't
I am.
Isn't Tim Robbins in that?
Tim Robbins was nice. In it. Ryan Phillippe was in it, but I didn't realize how bad that movie was until I started watching it again last night. But
yeah.
Had a nice, you know, had a lot of nice meaning to it, I guess. But
yeah.
So what's next for Coding Horror and yourself?
Right. So now that I don't work at Vertigo, now that the blog is sort of a full-time initiative, one thing I decided early on is, like, I looked at all the people I really respected. Now, granted, I respect a lot of people, but I mean the people that I viewed as like role models, people that I wanted to emulate. The thing that they had was they would write about stuff on their blog, but they weren't necessarily bloggers. They were still building stuff. I think it's hard to have credibility when you're not building anything from a technical perspective. If you're a technical person,
mm-hmm.
You tend to respect people who build stuff. And I agree with that. And I think actually you tend to get bored. It's like, I want to build something, right? Just, it's like you're a kid and, you know, you realize the computer's like the ultimate Lego set at some level. It's like,
oh, yeah.
I could build anything. Right? Like literally, you know, in my imagination, but the computer makes that real. And that's sort of the fantasy and the thing you get out of it. So I want to do both of those things. I'm going to be a full-time blogger, and I'm also going to build a web property. I can't talk about the details yet in terms of who it's going to be with and what it's going to be about, but I can tell you it's going to be a developer-oriented site, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be kind of about just putting good information out into the world, like saying, just kind of like what Wikipedia does. I mean, this is not in any way competition for Wikipedia, but in the sense that Wikipedia is like stuff we all do together.
Right.
And it increases the value of the information in the world, because I'm all about that.
Right.
I just believe in putting information that works for me, right, personally. It's like things I'm interested in, but also at a level where it's actually helping other people, and they can contribute. It's not like, you know, comments are on, right? And I've always said, and I will still say, you know, one of the biggest open secrets in blogging is often the best part of the blog post is below where the post ends. It's the comments.
Right.
Because that's where you start to see the different perspectives, mm-hmm. and the commentary and the things the poster forgot and the different pros and cons.
We kind of call that the continuing the conversation. You know, it's getting different insights. It's getting different views, like you said. And it's just, you know, it's okay, somebody said something. Now somebody can, you know, respond to that, and whether that's positive or negative, but it's continuing that conversation along. That's what's nice about blogging, is people, the reader has an opportunity to provide input into what that particular item is talking about.
Right. Yeah, and in a very positive way. I mean, Wikipedia, there's just no way it really should work. Like, if you think about the scale that it's on and
right.
the amount of vandalism and stuff that they have to deal with. And certainly on my side, a very nice, healthy little community has developed, and there's very little griefing or evil that I have to deal with, which is astonishing to me. But I think that proves that you can create positive communities. I think they have to be focused to some degree.
Sure.
You can't necessarily do that on the New York Times editorial page.
Right.
But in the circle of developers and the development community, I've been very humbled and gratified by the community that's grown up around my blog. And I want to take that energy and let other people, you know, collaboratively create things that are going to help other developers longer term.
Great. That'd be awesome. Just kind of, you know, you kind of brought up the New York Times, which kind of reminded me that my local newspaper from the town that I grew up in, the Quad Cities, the Quad City Times, actually allows people to comment on every single one of their articles. And it's kind of funny when, you know, somebody gets arrested for something, let's say, you know, like a white collar crime of some sorts, and the comments that come back, you know, throw the book at them, you know, this, and no, you don't understand the whole story. It's just interesting. It kind of adds a little bit of effect to that article in a sense, and, you know, how some people really read the article and some people kind of, you know, say they're reading something, you know, differently or what have you. So it's interesting. But, yeah, like you said, you know, this works for a small town newspaper and maybe not such a, you know, a large city like New York Times.
Yeah, scale is difficult to manage. But I think right now, to me, the internet is a bunch of interesting subcultures that intersect. And I think trying to be like – I think the worst example of comments is YouTube. Every now and then I'll see a YouTube comment that's actually worth reading, but 99% of the time it's like, I want that time back
that
I spent reading the YouTube comments, because it doesn't illuminate in any way.
Or dig.
But what you will find
comments,
what you will find is if it's a very specific video that only a small subsection of the world would be interested in, the comments tend to be much higher quality.
Right.
So I think it's all about finding those subcultures and actually building something that makes sense for that subculture, like what I want to do for developers. It's not for everybody. It's
right.
For developers who have, you know, technical questions and things that they're looking at. I think you can build a really powerful, positive community out of that.
That's what's great about the web is that, you know, it's not like there's any land that you're trying to claim. I mean, it's just, it's infinite, right? So if this this little subculture or this little town or city doesn't exist, well, here, let's go build it by just creating a website. And,
right.
And now it's there. And we can see how it grows by based on the community coming and contributing and adding value. And so, yeah, it's the web's, it's unbelievable.
Well, the other ironic thing about it to me is that a lot of people, I know certainly one of the reasons I got into computers is because people are, like, complicated. And computers tend to be devices you can control and understand at some level, at a very fundamental level. You can say exactly why everything is happening in the computer if you spend enough time working with it. That's just not possible with people. So a lot of people, certainly in my generation, got into computers. That was viewed as a highly solitary activity, right? You were highly disconnected when you're dealing with a computer. You were in the computer world. You didn't interact with other people. But now I think it's almost the opposite, where when you interact with a computer, the idea of a computer not connected to the internet, not connected to, you know, Twitter and instant messaging and email and exchange and all these things is like, why would you even bother having the computer at that
right.
point? Like the idea of a computer not connected to other people.
Right. It almost seems useless.
It's almost come full circle. And I think that's really powerful. And I think to me, the computer becomes a way for us to really connect with other people,
right.
You know, more so than the computer itself,
right.
Is sort of a side effect, which is interesting because that's certainly not what it was like. I think it was an escape valve in the early days for me,
right.
And now I feel like I want more interaction with people, and I kind of want to do it in this online way because it's captured forever and it's searchable, you know, and that sort of thing.
Right, and it's, I mean, back in the day, once again, you know, I had a Commodore 64 computer with a 1200 baud modem, and I actually ran a BBS. And to me, I thought that was the most amazing thing that, you know, I'm able to plug my phone into the, you know, to the computer, and now I'm able to communicate with all these other people that, you know, are able to find me. And I don't even remember how they found me back then, but you'd post your BBS posting on some other BBSs, and it just kind of grow organically from there. And it's like now today, it's like, it's kind of like the BBS mentality. And, you know, it's just the scale of it is just unbelievable. Like I said, all these different little subcultures, all these different communities. And, I mean, what you're doing, I hope it's successful, and I plan to be a part of it. And I'm actually looking for something like that. So before we go though, I got one last question to ask you. This is kind of, you know, once again, related to some of the offline topics we had this past week. And, you know, we talk about geek credibility, right? And so I want to ask you, what are your top three geek credibility movies on Jeff Atwood's list?
So movies that I would expect geeks to have seen.
Or no, what you think is, you know, a geek-worthy movie, or, you know, what are your top geek-worthy
movies?
Well,
I got to go with the classics, and by that I mean
we're going to throw antitrust out of there, by the way.
Right, of course. Well, naturally, and hackers should be thrown
hackers,
out as well. And also swordfish should be thrown out. But I got to go with kind of the classics. So I would say Terminator 2,
uh-huh.
Just in terms of the computer.
Two, not one.
Well, one's good, but two, I think, was the rare sequel is actually better than the original.
Yeah.
The original is great, too. Yeah. But the concept of Skynet, the whole idea that, you know, this could go horribly wrong was, I think, fascinating. Plus, just, yeah, it really works on so many levels.
Interesting, okay.
Yeah, I'd go with the Terminator 2, Skynet angle. And then, of course, The Matrix, I think. Again, it's a little cliche, but I think you got to go with The Matrix just in terms of the first movie, really.
The first Matrix.
Yeah. The second one wasn't too bad, but yeah, by the third one, they had totally lost it.
Right.
So I got to go with The Matrix. And then for the third one, I might actually go back to War Games because you brought it up. And actually, yeah, and I think depending on what age you are, I do think that was a very formative movie in terms of it showed modems, right? It showed, hey, computers aren't just about solitary hacking. They can actually change the world in a bad way, right? But this whole concept of reaching out and doing war dialing was a big deal. So just the aspect of computers reaching out into the world and touching other people and other computers, I think, was really powerful.
And then how many kids actually try to hack into their school's computer by using the password pencil?
Right. Yeah, totally. So I think I would go with maybe those three. There might be others I could pick, but I think you got to go with the classics.
That's right. Well, great. So obviously we'll keep an eye on codinghorror.com and keep an eye on what's going on in your world, and good luck with everything, and thanks for being on Thirsty Developer.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I enjoyed it.
Well, Dave, that was a really cool interview, man.
Yeah, so not many times do, during interviews do we actually ask, the person, what is your top three all-time geek, movies?
The next time I do an interview, we're sitting here at the deepern.net event in Milwaukee, and so I'm going to be talking to some of the speakers, in a few minutes. I'm going to ask them what
that's going to be the new standard Thirsty Developer question.
Yeah.
Top three geek movies of all time, go.
Yeah. We'll get tired of that pretty quick, because I think The Matrix will come up a lot.
Well, actually, there you go, Larry. What are your top three all-time geek movies? Let me ask you the question.
So I absolutely love Blade Runner. And, that's a great, science fiction film. The other movie the other two I like are not, necessarily technology related, but they're movies that make you think. The Princess Bride, Reiner's movie in the late 80s. And the other one is...
Inconceivable.
Yeah, inconceivable. The other one, that is a movie that I can watch over and over again because I'll never forget how shocked I was at the ending is The Usual Suspects.
Oh, okay.
And do you remember the Sixth Sense?
So this turned from top three geek movies into top three just movies. Right?
I'm a geek, so any movie I watch is,
those kind of movies have kind of a geek quality to them. Certainly Princess Bride does.
Oh, they certainly, and The Usual Suspect is just like The Sixth Sense, had the jaw-dropping ending or whatever.
Kaiser Soze?
Yeah, The Usual Suspects actually invented that. So those are three movies that I would definitely check out.
So I was actually kind of thinking of this, my top three geek movies, obviously War Games is probably the top. I mean, I watched that movie over and over and over and over again. How many people actually watched that movie and, try to hack into their high school, school's computer after watching
it? I think it started a lot of people our age programming.
Probably. But so War Games, then Real Genius with Val Kilmer.
That's a great movie.
That is a fantastic movie. So, cooking popcorn from outer space with using a really big laser.
Yeah.
And so my third movie, I'm kind of drawing a blank here. I mean, I know you could go with the standards like Star Wars and such, but I'm not enough of a Star Wars geek to really claim that and feel good about it. But, certainly the Star Wars series as a kid growing up, you kind of made you dream and kind of think of the possibilities and stuff. So I guess I'll stick with Star Wars, even though, if you quiz me on any Star Wars trivia, I'd probably get everything wrong.
And I can do that.
I know you could. I'm afraid that you're going to. So moving right along.
To Bloggy Chanel?
Yeah, we should move to Bloggy Chanel. We're not going to turn this into a movie podcast, but maybe that should be the standard question moving forward on all of our Thirsty Developer podcasts. But so Bloggy Chanel. So actually, I want to kind of point out somebody's blog you should know. And I think, Larry, you obviously already know this person's blog, but it's Tim Heuer, who is actually our friend down in Phoenix, Arizona. He's actually the developer evangelist down in Phoenix, Arizona, but
not
no
for
longer.
Much longer. Yeah,
actually, he just changed jobs. He has a new job actually working in Scott Guthrie's organization, where he's actually going to be kind of So you know how Scott Hanselman is this pseudo-developer liaison working for Scott Guthrie's organization? Well, Tim's going to be doing sort of the same thing where he's actually going to be evangelizing around Silverlight. So he's going to be doing a lot of stuff around Silverlight.net's website. He's going to be doing a lot of screencasts, tutorials, speaking at a lot of conferences and stuff. So Tim's actually going to be a great guy. He's going to be working with Jesse Liberty and doing that kind of stuff. So check out Tim Heuer. .com, which is his blog, and we'll put the show link up there for the spelling of Heuer. So
and he's got the most clever name for his blog, even though the URL is timheuer.com.
Right.
It's method tilde of object tilde failed.
how many of us have seen that?
Every one of us who started in the com era, remember that one, And it's like method tilde,
But yeah, actually, Tim is gaining, and I think I may have talked this about before in a previous episode, but so Tim is part of the Western Region evangelism team, and they've actually been going around sort of the Western United States and a big ass tour bus, rock star style, touring, different states, different locations, going to different code camps, visiting many different sort of customer locations, user group locations, and kind of just, spreading the message and kind of going out and sort of drumming up the buzz around, Microsoft's, technologies like IE8 and IS7, Silverlight and such. And so actually check out thecodetrip.com is another site to check out as well.
Yeah. So my blog is another developer evangelist, and this is a developer evangelist that we both know, and that is Jeff Brand, who's your counterpart up in the Twin Cities, up in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He covers the district kind of next to you and mine, and his blog is slickthought.net. And
he's also affectionately known as the .NET sex symbol as well.
Yeah, the self-proclaimed .NET sex symbol, you know.
Self-proclaimed.
You know, so Jeff's got he's got an interesting blog, but the reason I'm pointing people to that is that's where his spaghetti code series is. He's actually started a combination podcast, videocast, not as frequent as the Thirsty Developer. We try to do, you know, pretty much a weekly show. I think he does a couple a month or whatever. But he's now on iTunes and the Zune Marketplace, and, you know, that's just another thing that you can check out, you know. After you listen to the Thirsty Developer every week, then you can go check out the Spaghetti Code series.
Right.
And once again, slickthought.net.
Yeah, check it out. All right, so should we wrap up this week's show?
Yeah, we got to get back to deeper in .net here.
That's
because,
right.
You know, Richard Campbell's on stage right now speaking of podcasting.
That's
so.
Right. Richard Campbell of .net Rocks fame is on stage, so we got to get back to that. So with that, I think we're going to finish out this week's show. You can find myself at daveboss.com. You can find out Larry at larryclarkin.com. And where else, Larry?
Facebook and Twitter.
That's right. So with that, folks, we'll talk to you next week. Take care.